Support for this podcast is provided by Clark University's International Development, Community, and Environment Department. Administrations change. Global problems persist. Innovate solutions to global challenges like climate change, hunger, inequity, and injustice. Turn research into action. Apply at clarku.edu/IDCE.
Tackling street harassment today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Finland has a law designed to stop harassment in the streets. But there's a catch. The alleged perpetrator has to admit to committing the crime.
Yeah, I don't think if you see a cop and you go like, oh, this man is harassing me, like, you have the right to fine him. I don't think he's going to be like, yeah, I'm sorry, I did it.
Also, 10 years after her assassination, Pakistanis are still trying to figure out the legacy of Benazir Bhutto.
She's more of a saint today than she's a woman. But on a personal level, I've always looked back and, you know, understood that it is something exceptional for a woman in Pakistan to take the baton forward from her father.
Those stories plus a healthy dose of Chicano Batman today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you here today. Looking back over the past 12 months, one of the big stories can be summed up in a hashtag, Me Too, and in the Spanish-speaking world, Yo También. Today we get a perspective on this global reckoning over sexual harassment from Ana Marcos in Colombia. She's a journalist from Spain and writes for the Spanish newspaper El País. And she remembers the warning she got from friends and family when they found out she was moving to Colombia.
That is a very dangerous country, and it is very dangerous, or more dangerous, for women.
Sexual violence was a big part of Colombia's decades-long civil war, but generally the country has a high rate of violence against women. And as in many other countries, sexism is an entrenched reality for women in Colombia. Ana Marcos was in Colombia when the Me Too hashtag exploded a few months ago.
I wrote an article in El País talking about my experience with sexual harassment. I grew up in Spain, and during my youth, I didn't feel this was something important or to talk about. Now, what I see with young women, not only in Colombia, but all around the world, is that finally they are being aware of what is going on.
What was the reaction you got from women who read your story? And was reaction different between Colombian and Spanish readers?
Yes, it was different. I remember that most of my friends and colleagues from work, they told me that I was very brave, that they had suffered similar experiences. Here in Colombia, I received some similar comments, but only from women from higher class who have access to the internet, women who can travel to other countries, and also women who are part of different initiatives like social organizations which fight for women rights.
Yeah, so how has the Me Too, or in Colombia, it's a Yo También movement, how has it evolved since August from what you've seen there, and where is it at now?
I don't see a great evolution, to be sincere. I always compare Colombia with other South American countries like Argentina or Peru. In those two countries, there are huge women movements. Not only Me Too, but Ni Una Menos, which was a movement that started against every time a woman was killed because of sexual violence or gender violence. Here in Colombia, it's not the same. Of course, I don't want to generalize. There are some movements and many women that are trying to fight for their rights. But at the end of the day, you don't see that kind of conversations or topics in the bars or friends talking about it during a lunch or having a beer.
There's a statistic that Colombia's public prosecutor's office has wheeled out that only 1 in 10 women who suffer violence actually report it to the police. Is this an epidemic of silence in Colombia?
For me, it is. It is because Every time I've talked with these women, I went to the south of Colombia, to Tumaco, to cover how sexual violence affected women in that region. Mm. Now they are part of an initiative called No es hora de callar. It is not time to remain silent. And now they know they have to talk about it. They know they have to report, and they know they have to help other women. First, they thought it was better not to talk about it because you can get in more trouble. It's not only the way they were educated and the social pressure, it's also that every time they tried to report, they found no answer because there was no state where they live, no government, and no official institutions, or because when they tried to do something, what they were given back was more violence because of the war.
So, Ana, what for you would really help change Colombia's culture of sexual harassment and violence?
For me, it's always education. Knowing that they deserve the same treatment that any men, that they are not wives or mothers, that they are women who can choose, I think things will change in Colombia.
Ana Marcos is a journalist and writer based in Bogota, Colombia. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for your time.
In some countries, the Me Too campaign has also triggered proposals for changes to the law. Imagine, for example, a fine that men would face if they're caught in the act of catcalling or harassing women in the street. In France, lawmakers are looking into this. Rebecca Rossman is usually based in Paris, but a month ago she traveled to Finland, where a similar street harassment law has been in place for a few years now, to see how it's working out there.
If you're visiting Finland in November, the first thing you should know is that it's going to be cold. Really cold. Even locals prefer to stay inside. This may help explain why the number of reported street harassment incidents goes down significantly every winter.
You could maybe say that we also have like seasonal harassment. But definitely a decrease in wintertime.
That's Mia Haglund. She's the Secretary General of the Nordic Green Left Alliance, a coalition of left-wing political parties. We're sitting in a cafe in central Helsinki talking about Finland's street harassment law, which on paper is one of the most comprehensive in the world. Here, if you're caught sexually harassing someone in a public space, you risk an immediate fine, anywhere from a couple hundred to several thousand euros, depending on your income. But there's some fine print. One, there must be a witness. Two, the law only applies to physical harassment, not verbal harassment like catcalling. Then there's this.
The one who is suspected for the crime has to admit it.
Måns Enqvist is Finland's national police superintendent. He says if the suspect doesn't admit to the crime, the case can go to court. It's up to the victim. He also tells me that so far this year, fewer than 20 people have agreed to be fined for street harassment.
Still, the numbers are low.
I went out to talk with women on the street about what they think of the law, but another issue came up.
Do you know about a law here that's been in place now for about 3 years that says if you're harassed in a public space, the harasser could technically be fined on the spot? Do you know about this law?
No.
No, I don't.
No one knows about it.
It sounds quite logical, but then didn't you say something that the harasser has to admit it? Yeah, I don't think. I mean, if you see a cop and you go like, "Oh, this man is harassing me," like, do you have the right to fine him? I don't think he's gonna be like, "Yeah, I'm sorry, I did it."
Another thing the women on the street tell me, even if they did know about the law,
there's maybe not enough policemen here. There should be someone you could find immediately.
I think to apply the law, you need to have a lot more policemen.
It's hard to find comparative statistics, but the numbers of reported incidents here seem relatively low. Fewer than 300 cases in all of Finland in 2015. The following year, it jumped to more than 500, which could just mean more people are reporting street harassment. But the spike came at a time when Finland was having a debate about immigration, and some have blamed asylum seekers for a rise in street harassment, though there's no concrete evidence to back that up. Again, Mia Haglund.
It's easier for Finnish people to be like, oh, okay, so it's not us, it's them. Because, of course, it's really hard to address harassment culture. It's really hard to look yourself in the mirror and be like, hey, I might be contributing to a harassment culture.
Haglund says she supports expanding the law to cover verbal harassment. But more important than any legislation, she says, the key to addressing harassment culture starts with that inward reflection. For the World, Rebecca Rossman, Helsinki.
African Parks is a nonprofit based in South Africa. It manages 13 national parks in 9 African countries, and the group is not afraid to use tough tactics against poachers. My BBC colleague Alistair Leithhead visited Zakouma National Park in Chad to find out more. His story begins as he's observing elephants with a ranger.
There were more than 20,000 elephants in this park just 40 years ago, but now there are just over 500. What's encouraging, though, is that they've now got babies. They're reproducing. Their numbers are starting to go up, and if the poachers can be kept at bay, the population's going to recover.
There used to be elephant carcasses everywhere. Zakouma National Park's head of law enforcement, Satanga de Gringa, told me as we flew 500 feet above the ground.
So what's the difference been since African Parks took over?
Since African Parks arrived here, we no longer see carcasses of elephants in the park, he said. The herd is doing well. The elephants are no longer nervous. That means there's no poaching. But it's come at a cost.
Mahamat Abaka, Mando Auguste, Zakaria Mahamat.
There's a long list of names on the memorial to lost rangers.
Usman Issa, Ahmad Mahamat, Zakaria Amadi.
Les braconniers, c'est des braconniers soudanais. Ils étaient au nombre de 8 personnes.
They were Sudanese poachers and there were 8 of them, Ranger Abakar Jacko told me. They ambushed, as he said. We walked straight into it. I lost 2 friends. There have been many stories like this over the years. Ranger Jacko leads the Hornbill Horseback Patrol. It's easier to spot tracks on horses, and it's how the Sudanese have poached elephants here for centuries to serve the Nile ivory trade. But automatic weapons now allow killing on an industrial scale.
So we have rangers. Due to the threat that they face, they are military trained.
Leon Lamprecht is Zakouma Park manager.
They're ultimately doing law enforcement and not military operations. We're trying to stop poachers before they kill the assets that we protect.
It's all coordinated from the radio room. Elephants with tracking collars are followed on a computer screen. The patrols circle the herd from afar 24/7. And there are radios in local villages as an early warning system.
Oh, merci.
African Parks has built schools to win local community support. Education develops poor villages and teaches kids why the park's important. That's also why the EU is one of the biggest donors, alongside rich conservationists. By patrolling, by keeping good community relations and taking ultimate responsibility, Zakouma hasn't lost an elephant in 18 months or a ranger in 5 years. It's going so well that 6 black rhinos will be relocated here from South Africa in the new year. African Parks now manages 13 protected areas in 9 countries. Its chief executive is Peter Fernhead.
Protected areas, if they're not being looked after, they are being lost. So there's an extreme sense of urgency to be able to make sure that as many of these areas are looked after today. Because if they're not being looked after today, they are not going to be there tomorrow. And that's what our responsibility is, African Parks, to look after as many of these areas to make sure that they survive the next 10 years, the next 20 years, so that in the generations to come have the opportunity to decide what they want to do with those national parks.
The main thrust is making sure governments are fully behind the work they do. Chad has just asked them to extend their management of Zakouma and take on another park. While Chad isn't top of most people's safari list, high-end tourists are now paying thousands to glamp at Zakouma. That still only covers a third of the costs, and more dangerous places are even more expensive. With Prince Harry as president, they're hoping the support will continue, and the parks and their elephants will be protected for now.
The BBC's Alistair Leithhead reporting from Zakouma National Park in Chad. Up next on the show, Benazir Bhutto's legacy 10 years after her death. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. 10 years ago today, Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. She was shot and killed at a rally in the Pakistani city of Rawalpindi. She had been campaigning to become Pakistan's prime minister for a third time. Benazir Bhutto and her family dominated the country's politics for decades. She was the daughter of a former Pakistani leader who was executed in the late 1970s by the general who then ran Pakistan. In the late 1980s, she succeeded that same general to become the first woman to rule the country. Another decade later, her two terms in office ended under a cloud of corruption allegations against her and her husband. Until the end, Benazir Bhutto rejected those accusations as politically motivated. And for many Pakistani women and girls, to this day, Bhutto's long political career is proof that gender barriers can be overcome in Pakistan's conservative society. That's how my next guest looks at it. Pakistani journalist Amara Ahmad was in her first year of university when Bhutto was killed in 2007. So, Amara, you wrote an essay today, essentially a tribute to Benazir Bhutto, and you said that she is a potent symbol for you, but it wasn't always that way. How was Bhutto portrayed in your family when you were growing up?
Benazir was portrayed as someone who was very corrupt, someone who was power hungry, someone who was greedy, someone who was cashing upon her father's name. She could go to any height in order to get her power or whatever she wanted. She was a very negative figure, and my family used to vote for her opponent, which is the PMLN. And some of the things that people in my family used to say were very sexist.
So tell us what actually changed your mind about Benazir Bhutto.
I was doing an English literature class, and that was before she had died. And one of my literature teachers, she said that because she was a mother, and she was a new mother. She had one baby just 6 months before, and she was saying, I don't know how Benazir pulled this off, because I'm totally worked up, and Benazir has been running a political party, she's been running a country, and she's a mother as well. And that sort of shed some light that Benazir has been doing more work than we actually give her credit for. And gradually, as the years passed, I saw that women are generally not as ambitious as they are at school level. Eventually, when it comes to picking up a profession or a personal life, women usually went for a personal life. And having a husband and a child was way more important than following a career.
I mean, Benazir Bhutto was also an elite. She probably had lots of help, nannies, that kind of thing.
That is right. But many of my friends are also elites and upper middle class, and they can afford to stretch the limits, but they don't. They don't want to push the envelope simply because it's inconvenient. And it takes a lot of bravery to do that. Just imagine that you go to a parliament which is full of men, and you are the prime minister, and they're jeering at you, and you need your party members to save you from those fellow parliamentarians. And you're the prime minister, and you know that you can be physically harmed in the parliament. It's a huge price that she was paying. Somebody sitting in Britain doesn't, I don't think in the West people understand the kind of environment that there is.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Amara. I mean, you're a journalist, you found a career, and you're working. How much of your life today do you attribute to Benazir Bhutto being a role model of sorts?
I wouldn't say that she's all present and always there, because in my career, she's been gone for quite some time. And gradually, she's been sanitized. And she's more of a saint today than she's a woman. But on a personal level, I've always looked back and seen her and read her book and, you know, understood that it is something exceptional for a woman in Pakistan to take the baton forward from her father, and not to comfortably transition into a married life that gives you all the support that you need in life.
A friend I follow on Twitter wrote today that Pakistan still has not recovered since the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. Do you agree with that? And what has Bhutto's killing left unresolved for you 10 years later?
Personally, I would have wanted, as a young woman, to be living in a country with a woman prime minister. I had never seen that. I was very little when Benazir was in power. And, you know, that too, a woman who was against the Taliban, against the militants, was a liberal, was a pure Democrat. Without any doubt, Benazir has never supported a military regime. And it would have been a pleasure to see what she could do for women, for young girls.
It was a very challenging time for a woman to pursue the chief executive of Pakistan. I'm just wondering, she so skillfully navigated Pakistan's politics that do you think maybe she became more a political animal than really a catalyst for real change?
I don't think there can be any revolution or there can be any big catalyst for any great change. I think Pakistan has always had tiny changes, tiny policy works, and little by little we move forward. And of course, we have great setbacks in the middle. But I think the little work that she would have done, it would have been of a great help. And the climate had changed in 2008. It had become much more woman-friendly. At that time, even our speaker was a woman. Fehmida Mirza was a woman. And I would have loved to see Fehmida Mirza as the speaker and then Benazir as the prime minister. It would have been quite a sight. And she wouldn't have been ideal. People's Party is always prone to corruption. And there is this certain demand of running a government itself, which forces politicians into compromises. But as a young woman, I would love to see the Chief Justice of Pakistan as a woman, the Chief of Army Staff as a woman. Why not?
Yeah, why not? That was journalist Amara Ahmad in Karachi, Pakistan, telling us what the late Benazir Bhutto means to her. Here's a quick one before the break. It's about this week's World Speed Chess Championships being held in Saudi Arabia. The tournament is part of a push by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to improve the kingdom's international image. About 200 chess players from all around the globe are taking part. But reigning world champion Anna Muzychuk from Ukraine won't be one of them. She told the BBC she's boycotting the event to protest the treatment of women in Saudi Arabia.
I think that the championships of such a level, world championships, shouldn't be organized in the country where the human rights and especially the rights of women are violated.
Muzychuk wrote on her Facebook page that the laws governing what women can or can't do in Saudi Arabia would have made her feel like a secondary creature, her words. The Saudi government has relaxed at least one of those rules for the tournament this week. Women competing in the events are not required to cover up with a hijab or abaya. The only requirements are trousers and high-necked blouses. But that was not enough for the Ukrainian champ to call off her boycott, even though at a previous tournament in Iran, Muzychuk did compete and she did wear a head covering.
I decided to go there. And I felt myself how it is to be in hijab all the time and all this pressure when women don't have the same rights as men. That's why it was even more wish not to play in Saudi, because in Saudi it seems to be even worse.
Muzychuk won't be the only one missing the tournament. Players from Iran and Qatar, regional political rivals to Saudi Arabia, have had trouble getting Saudi visas in time, and Israeli players have had their visas denied altogether.
It's a pity, and in some way it's also a violation of the statute of our World Chess Federation. FIDE events must be held in the country where all players can come.
Ukraine's Anna Muzychuk speaking there to the BBC about her refusal to defend her two world speed chess titles this week in Saudi Arabia. I'm Marco Werman. A former British soldier and a war surgeon have teamed up to help Syrian kids.
We've seen the worst that people can do to each other, and if we can get the ear of the likes of President Trump, I think that's our role, and you know, we will continue to do it with every nerve and sinew that we have.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The word siege has a medieval ring to it, but sieges are part of modern warfare, too, with harsh consequences for civilians who often end up trapped in the middle. We're reminded of that again by the war in Syria. Take eastern Ghouta, a district near Damascus that's been blockaded by government forces since 2013. Nothing can get in and out. No food, no medicine, no people.
Warehouses are almost empty. They don't have fuel. They don't have constant electricity. They are shutting down incubators. They are shutting down operating rooms because there is no fuel. And prices for smugglers is so high, you have to multiply by 10.
That's a Syrian doctor speaking anonymously to the BBC. He's in close touch with his colleagues in Ghouta.
We have about 1,200 patients with cancer. We don't have enough medication for those patients, and doctors inside Ghouta are struggling to deal with them. We have more than five kids who have trauma injuries. One of the patients has lost, Karim, lost part of his left eye and part of his cranium, and he needs reconstructive surgery. There is another boy called Qasim. He needs reconstructive facial surgery, and he's having difficulty to breathe.
Then last night came a glimmer of hope. A handful of critically sick people, including children, were allowed out of Ghouta. Hamish de Breton Gordon is an advisor to the nonprofit organization, the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations, and he's been actively lobbying for just such a release. Can you tell us what is the latest, Hamish?
Well, last night, as you've reported, 29 children were allowed out of Ghouta to receive desperately needed medical treatment that they couldn't get in the Ghouta. As you heard from the Syrian doctor, things are desperate there. There's been no medicines or medical equipment getting into Ghouta and no food. Children are actually dying of malnutrition. And in my role with OSIM, along with my colleague, Dr. David Knott, we have been speaking to President Assad and also the Russian hierarchy over the last 10 days when we heard about the children with cancer. Trying to get a ceasefire to allow these children out, because the seven young children with cancer, their cancer is entirely treatable, but they will die if they don't get help. And I'm glad to say that two of them are now on their way out. So a little ray of hope in what has been an absolutely desperate civil war.
I mean, we should say that you and Dr. Knott are not just lobbying. You've been crucial, along with other people and groups, for this kind of evacuation. But I'm just wondering, who have you been calling to try to make this happen?
Well, I'd just like to restate, you know, we are but a small bit of the overall picture. The United Nations are working terribly hard. A lot of governments are. But 12 months ago, almost to the day, Dr. David Knott and I managed to persuade Assad and Putin to let 500 people out of Aleppo. So we repeated the task. We have managed to get a direct line into Assad, and David spoke to Assad this morning and said that, you know, actually we really need to get all those other children out of Ghouta. And there are about 500 adults who desperately need medical support. And also the other thing is to get humanitarian aid in. There are 400,000 people who haven't received food from outside for 4 years.
So, as I said, we're talking up to 29 people evacuated or approved for evacuation, and the numbers are not totally confirmed. But this does seem like a fraction of the number of people who need help. What hope is there for those who are left behind?
Well, you're right. It is a small number, but this is the first in 4 years. So I don't think we don't want to overplay it, but we don't want to underplay it. In David's talk with Assad this morning,
Dr. Knott,
he suggested that there would be others allowed out, and we reinforce the requirement that we need to get aid in. So hopefully this will be the start, and that's why we're trying to galvanize world leaders. And you know, if I could have a 5-minute or a 2-minute phone call with President Trump, I would be asking him if he could put his weight behind the peace process, the UN peace process, to ensure that we get a fair peace rather than one just brokered by President Putin.
There are news reports that say the rebels struck a quid pro quo with the Syrian government for the release of these prisoners. What do you know about that?
Well, I can't confirm or deny any of that. I really don't have that information. However, having spent 30 years on the battlefields of the world myself, 25 as a soldier with many tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that this was a zero-sum deal. And there are reports that some Syrian regime prisoners were released. That is probably the price one has to pay.
Now, Ghouta is run by an Islamist rebel faction, Jaish al-Islam. It's not ISIS, but it's pretty out there on the extremes. Does that fact affect your lobbying efforts on behalf of the sick people of Ghouta?
It's very difficult. These things are far from perfect, far from straightforward. And sometimes you have to do deals with people that you really don't like. But if it means saving some children who are the future of Syria, then these are decisions we have to take on their merits.
Hamish, your background is as a chemical weapons expert. You're not a doctor. Why is this so important to you?
Well, my background really is a soldier. I was a British soldier for 25 years. I fought in both Gulf Wars. I did multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. I've really seen the worst that people can do. My technical skills are in the chemical weapons field, and I've investigated chemical weapons usage in Syria over the last 6 years. And that's taken me into Syria and seen some pretty horrific things. One gets very deeply involved, and I think particularly what David and I have is we do have contacts and people, you know, will listen to us. So perhaps we do that lobbying at the very highest levels where others can't. And that leads to some sort of resolution, some sort of peace and a future for these children. Then I think that's our role. And, you know, we will continue to do it with, you know, every nerve and sinew that we have.
Hamish de Breton Gordon is an advisor to the charity group OSIM, that's the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations, and he's been lobbying for the evacuation of sick and wounded civilians from the besieged district of Ghouta in Syria. Hamish, thank you very much.
A great pleasure, and thank you for sparing the airtime.
There are millions of Syrians who've simply left the country, same with Iraqis who fled violence there. Yesterday on the show, we heard the story of a Yazidi family from Iraq that's starting life over in France. Today, Gene Carstensen takes a deeper look at the city that took them in.
Saint-Nazaire is known for its shipyards. It's a place in northwestern France where workers construct the world's largest cruise liners.
Here, it's a ship belonging to MSC, Mediterranean Shipping Company.
It's also known for the welcome it gives to refugees. Around much of France, anti-immigrant sentiment is on the rise, but not in Saint-Nazaire. It's a mainly working-class city that is a stronghold of the left. Beginning in early 2016, the city was one of the first in France to accept Syrian and other refugees as part of the EU's relocation program.
Pour slogan dans les armes de la ville, dans la tradition française, une ville qui ouvre et qui ne ferme jamais.
This is the mayor, David Samson. He calls Saint-Nazaire the city that is open and never closes. As a port city, it's been that way for centuries. But Samsung says its current openness to refugees also has roots in World War II. Saint-Nazaire was under heavy Nazi occupation and wasn't liberated until the last day of the war in 1945.
Je sais que je parle à des Américains et vous avez été.
It was the Americans who liberated this city, Samsung tells me. So we have the habit of seeing people who don't come from our culture as coming to free us.
It's important to know that Saint-Nazaire have a very special history because Saint-Nazaire was destroyed at more than 80% during the Second World War.
This is Patrice Kalar. He's a school teacher from Saint-Nazaire. We chat over a lunch of Brittany-style buckwheat crepes. Kalar's grandfather was a war refugee during World War II.
He was obliged to leave Saint-Nazaire to escape the bombing. In his refuge, he met my grandmother.
His grandparents were war refugees. So when he saw the now famous photo of a Syrian refugee boy laying dead on a beach, he decided to do something. 2 years ago, he teamed up with some friends to form a volunteer group. Why did you want to help the refugees here?
Without war refugees, I wouldn't exist. So this is my personal reason.
The government pays for basic food and housing for about 200 refugees in Saint-Nazaire. But volunteers like Kalar do everything else, from teaching French to helping families navigate daily life. He takes me to visit a Syrian family he's gotten to know. His young son joins us as we huff up five flights of stairs in the public housing project where they live.
All refugees are loving my son.
He makes
them to laugh.
We find Kalar's friend Mahmoud Al-Hayak at the top of the stairs.
Do you speak English?
Je parle français, je parle anglais.
Kalar also makes Mahmoud laugh. It's clear they've formed a deep bond. Al-Hayak says people like Patrice Kalar have made him feel welcome in Saint-Nazaire.
J'aime bien ici parce qu'il y a de mes amis, comme Patrice.
He says he likes it here now because he has friends. like Patrice. They're not volunteers. They're my friends. Al Hayek's story is a little different from that of other refugees arriving in France. He didn't just learn French. He was an engineering student in Paris in his youth before moving back to Aleppo to marry and have a family. Then in 2016, he had to flee Syria with his wife and three children after his home and electronics business were totally destroyed in the war. While entering Greece by land from Turkey as refugees, their eldest daughter was killed by a train.
So when the train went by, they all jumped off, but they couldn't find one daughter?
Yeah.
They were stuck in Greece for months after the accident. But then France accepted the family for relocation. Luckily for them, they landed in Saint-Nazaire. Later, in town, I visit a French class for refugees. The teachers are volunteers from all walks of life and seem as eager as Kaylar to make the newcomers feel welcome. I ask Jean-Luc, a retired engineer, why he takes the time to volunteer.
J'aime rencontrer les gens.
I love to meet people. It's very simple.
But you don't have to go too far from Saint-Nazaire to find people who aren't as open about inviting newcomers into their community. Local journalist Christophe Francois, who showed me around the shipyard in Saint-Nazaire, drives me through the elegant resort town of La Boule, just 20 minutes away.
Here we are in the west entry of La Boule.
The country club, the first thing we see.
Yes, exactly. It's a country club with a special stadium for horses competitions.
The central market is a glittering gourmet food extravaganza filled with well-heeled shoppers.
How does this market compare to the market in Saint-Nazaire?
Nothing to compare. Everything is beautiful, seems so fine, and everything is in order.
Unlike Saint-Nazaire, La Boule hasn't taken in any refugees. It's not a right-wing town, but it's much wealthier and more insular. Christophe and I interview some locals outside the market, and I get a sense of a community that doesn't want to have its routines disturbed. Some don't want to talk at all, especially when they hear I'm asking about refugees.
Elle a suivi des familles de réfugiés qui sont partis de Grèce. Ah bon, d'accord.
She didn't want to.
No,
didn't
just
seem...
after the world refugee.
Others do engage. I meet Catherine and Christiane, two elderly friends who won't give their last names.
Qui sont OK pour faire des efforts, pour apprendre à parler français.
They say France should help war refugees, but only on the condition that they adopt French ways.
Imposer leurs coutumes dans en France.
Ah non, ça non, non.
Back in Saint-Nazaire, Mahmoud Al-Hayek's son and daughter play and count out loud. They count in Greek, which they learned in the refugee camps. Then in the Arabic they grew up with in Syria. After a year, they already speak excellent French as well. I asked Patrice Kaylar about what refugees need to feel at home in a place like Saint-Nazaire.
The first for integration is the French language. The longer they can't practice French, the longer they can't integrate.
But he also thinks local people have a responsibility to help refugees succeed.
The citizens of the place have to make an effort to welcome them, to meet them, and to share their culture.
Kaylar has certainly done that with Mahmoud Al-Hayek and his family. They had planned to move to Paris once they got settled in France. After all, Al-Hayek knows the city well from his years as an engineering student there. But now they plan to stay and make their new home in Saint-Nazaire. With Patrice, my friend, he says. He's not my friend. He's my family.
My life here now.
For the world, Jean Carstensen, Saint-Nazaire, France.
Jean's reporting is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. This won't come as a surprise, but President Trump is not popular in Mexico. Many Mexicans find his anti-immigrant rhetoric insulting. But that's not to say that similar sentiments don't exist in Mexico. Levi Bridges reports from a small town in the southern state of Oaxaca.
The town of Chuites is about 200 miles north of the border with Guatemala. About the only thing going on here is a construction site, where a few guys mix cement and hammer boards. Chuites is a sleepy little railroad town, surrounded by mango farms. But this rural village is surprisingly international.
My name is Juan Vicente, and I grew up in the United States. I lived over for 33 years, and I got deported.
Vicente grew up outside Los Angeles and is from El Salvador. He now digs holes and pours concrete here at the construction site. Migrants like Vicente are now spending more and more time in southern Mexican towns like Chuites. Most used to just pass right through on top of La Bestia, the train migrants travel on across Mexico. But today, immigration agents patrol the train.
They check for people, illegal people.
So now, most migrants just walk north along the railroad tracks. The journey walking through southern Mexico can take weeks. This all started 3 years ago, back when Mexico implemented something called the Southern Border Program. It's an immigration enforcement plan supported with millions of dollars in U.S. funding. The program created new immigration checkpoints on highways and trains here, and brought some unintended consequences. While violence against migrants in this part of Mexico has long been a problem, people here say it's getting worse now that migrants avoid the train and walk along the tracks instead. Armed gangs often wait to rob them there. Vicente says that's what happened to him when a group of guys with a gun stopped him on the tracks.
They took my shoes off. They ripped them.
So they ripped your shoe open they use a knife?
They had a knife. They had a machete.
Dead bodies have started regularly showing up in Chuites. Throughout the country, 2017 is on track to become the most violent year on record, with much of the blame going to Mexico's drug cartels. But many people here blame the rise in violent crime on Central American migrants. Then Leobardo Ramos burst onto the political scene. He promised to clean up Chuites by getting migrants out of town when he ran for municipal president last year. It earned him a new title. On the news, they've taken to calling him the Donald Trump of Oaxaca.
El Trump oaxaqueño.
El Trump oaxaqueño. Las sociales le apodan el Trump oaxaqueño.
Ramos became the municipal president of Chuites in a landslide victory. He said in interviews that, unlike Trump, he has nothing against undocumented immigrants. He's just kicking migrants out of his town because voters asked him to. Ramos was instrumental in getting the local migrant shelter here closed down last summer. Today, the building sits abandoned. Immigration agents now patrol Chuites, and lots of people in this town are on edge. Locals near the old migrant shelter say they've gotten ferocious guard dogs or put stronger locks on their doors to protect themselves from migrants. Maria Lopez, one of the neighbors who rallied to close the shelter down, says migrants are nothing but trouble.
Son muy drogaditos, ¿no?
They're all addicted to drugs, Lopez says.
Ahí está el baño.
She points to her bathroom, a small shack outside her house. Lopez says she was afraid just to go to the bathroom at night. What if one of them gets inside our house while I'm in the bathroom, kills my husband, and robs us? She asks. Lopez says she doesn't understand how migrants could just up and leave their families behind. Then, in the next breath, Lopez says she also has a son who went north, now an undocumented immigrant in Texas.
In Houston.
But Lopez says her son in Houston isn't a criminal. He's different from Central American migrants in Mexico. Jessica Cardenas, a former staff member at the migrant shelter in Chuites, says it's easy for locals to just blame Mexico's problems on foreigners.
Justo lo que pasa en Chuites es una pequeña imagen.
What happens in Chuites is a little example of what happens to migrants all over the world. Here people say they take our jobs, they're rapists, they're delinquents. That's exactly what they say about Mexicans in the United States.
Despite the local clampdown, It appears that even the Oaxacan Trump can't totally stop migration. Down by the train tracks, I meet six guys from Honduras near an old rail station with peeling yellow paint. They just walked into town and weren't even sure where they'd arrived.
Cacahuita, how you call it?
Chahuites.
Chahuites.
These young men were all deported from the U.S. They left family and kids there. Now they're trying to make it back to the cities they left.
Houston, otros a Miami, Phoenix.
These guys say lots of folks in Mexico have actually treated them really well. And that's because many communities here are just as divided on immigration as the U.S. right now. The young men standing here say lots of people have given them rides and food, whatever they can spare.
Mom, can you give me
beans.
Like a piece of cheese?
A piece of tortilla.
Yeah, sure, you know.
Yeah, man.
In Mexico, it's a good people, you know. Yeah.
Still, some of the young men here say they're done with Mexico and the U.S.
It's more easy in Canada than in the United States.
But Canada is still thousands of miles and two international border crossings away. From here, they'll keep walking. For the world, Levi Bridges, Chahuites, Mexico.
Just enough time before credits roll to dip into one of our top music picks for 2017. And for that, I turn to Bardo Martinez of the band in question.
We all need a superhero in our lives. We all need something to look up to. We happen to put the names together, and it creates this weird juxtaposition. It just keeps you wondering, what does that mean? So obviously it makes for a good band name.
And that name is Chicano Batman.
You've got an open heart, so you share what's inside, thinking that all is said in confidence, but then you realize.
This was the year we all needed a superhero, and for us at The World, Chicano Batman delivered with their 2017 release, Freedom is Free, retro soul with heavy doses of Latin psychedelia. That's Chicano Batman, and they made our list this year. If you want to see the list and listen to all our favorites, head over to PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks very much for being with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.